Then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Exodus 19:16 is one of many Bible passages attesting to the power of the trumpet. In more recent years, the instrument has taken on quite a few other attributes as well. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Whether it's the voice of proclamation or a soft and sultry voice of the night, the trumpet has many personalities, and here to introduce us to some of them is John Ailey, professor of trumpet at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Norman?
I want to start by asking you about your choice of your instrument. I assume you're passionate about the trumpet. Why the trumpet?
Well, how far do you want to go back?
Exodus.
Exodus. That's a little young for me. No. I started in fourth grade, had a terrific public school instructor by the name of Vernon Hayes. I still remember it. He was a trumpet player himself. He gave me, he didn't give me private lessons, but when he did, they were $2 for a half an hour. Can you imagine? Things have changed a bit. And I studied with him all through elementary school and junior high. And then I started at Wichita State University and studied with the trumpet professor there, Walter Myers, all through my undergraduate days as well, high school and undergraduate days. Studied with Robert Nagel at Yale and New York freelance experience, and here I am. But I knew in eighth grade that I wanted to be a trumpet player.
Why? So,
that's good.
Why, though?
Because I love it. I love what it does. I love the music that we get to play. I love all the different styles that we play. Orchestral, jazz, big band, jazz, I mean the improvisatory stuff, big band, and, particularly brass quintet. I enjoy that a lot.
Now, the instrument itself appears fairly simple in terms of just a few vowels, right? And it's a lot of mouth action.
Well, it is a lot of mouth action. Trumpet, of course, has a cup-shaped mouthpiece. It has three vowels. All the vowels on the instrument are descending. If you press down the first valve, you'll get a whole step lower. Press down the second valve, you get a half step lower. You press down the third valve, you get a step and a half. Well, all of a sudden, we now have, with the open combination and any of the combination of the valves working by themselves or together, we have the chromatic scale. And the valve came along in the early 1800s and was such that the Germans had the rotary valve and the French and the English used the piston valve. But this instrument has really been in that shape, probably for the last 180 years. So thankfully they've improved on it. I've had the opportunity to play instruments of the period, and while they sounded good, they had some rather noticeable intonation difficulties.
Let's go to the Baroque era, when we have just an incredible wealth of music with the trumpet in it, often prominently. Were there particular uses to which the trumpet was put? In other words, would a composer say, well, I need something festive here, or I need something ceremonial, or I need something with a particular military cast to it, or do we see a more general use?
All of that. Absolutely all of that. The trumpet has always been used throughout history as a signaling device. And then when we get into the Baroque period, all of a sudden we have our trumpet players organized into guilds. And the subdivision of any guild would have been those trumpet players who could play the high notes in the clarino register and those trumpet players that could play very strongly and in tune in the low register, and they were called the principale players. Well, you also had the musicians who would do the signaling for the city or the town usage, you know, from sounding the hour, if you will, to, I don't know, it's time for garbage pickup or something, you know.
But, why don't we do that now?
Unions, too.
No, those unions,
I don't know. All of those activities that you mentioned would have a trumpet player. Of course, with royalty, any kind of state occasion would always have the trumpet players. And the trumpet players were considered royal because they were always on the right side of the king. So it just all this silly stuff that we've learned.
Can you give us a sample of a sort of Baroque piece using trumpet?
I have a recording of Nicholas Eklund, probably one of the premier Baroque trumpet players today, And he is playing a piece called Tromba di Assonia from La Flora by Ziani. He's playing with soprano Maria Keohane. I think that's just remarkable playing and singing.
And it sounds so good with the soprano-trumpet combination.
Well, particularly the cornetto that I mentioned earlier, and in this setting as well with the clarino trumpet. The attempt to always match the timbre and the quality, the further quality of the voice is always the desire. Eklund plays so skillfully with his dynamics and his articulation and so on. And what you were hearing, if I recall correctly, having talked with him about this, this is just really like one microphone. And what you hear is the harpsichord and the voice and the trumpet, and it's very real. And I've heard him play live with an orchestra with original stringed instruments and so on. It sounds terrific. It just sounds this way all the time. It's just beautiful musical playing.
Now, the tuning of an orchestra varies from Baroque to modern and from pre-Baroque in terms of where you set your A. How do you accommodate for that with trumpet?
Trumpets of this era had crooks that would lengthen or shorten it. The Baroque trumpets I have, if I were to play Brandenburg II on my Baroque trumpet, I have it's in F at A440, which is modern pitch. And then I have a crook for E natural that I could play at modern pitch, or it would be roughly equivalent to F at 415 with some accurate tuning of the, or placing rather, of the tuning bit.
So you're ready to go, just about any ensemble.
Right. And trumpets of the Baroque era had all kinds of different shapes, but they were basically once, twice, wrapped three times, so the length would be manageable.
So if you play in the Bach Brandenburg, you use a different trumpet than if you're playing in a modern piece?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Exactly. If I'm playing Brandenburg II with modern instruments, I'm playing a four-valved B-flat piccolo, which is a minor seventh shorter than concert pitch.
Does Bach, I know in his cantatas, for example, you'll use specific instruments for a specific effect. Does he do that sort of thing with the trumpet in say, the Brandenburg?
There's a lot of conjecture with that. A lot of horn players think that Brandenburg II was written for the horn and not the trumpet. Well, they can think whatever they wish. But once you hear a recording of somebody playing the natural F trumpet with Baroque instruments all the rest of the way around, you'll never imagine it on horn because there is such a quality of brilliance. You know, it's the most brilliant sounding instrument of the group, even more brilliant than the transverse flute or the oboe. And I think that's what Bach had in mind.
get ready to play something like that? Because it sounds almost like an athletic feat. The instrument is moving so much. And what do you have to do to get ready for something like that?
Practice, practice, practice. Just like any other physical challenge that you have, the facial muscles, the embouchure muscles, they have to be trained over and over and over again. The repetition is what allows the muscles to hold the aperture that controls the different pitches that we play on any trumpet, modern trumpet or the older ones, to be accurate and to be easily accommodated.
But what about the mouth itself? I've seen trumpet players and they're always doing something with their mouth.
Imagine that.
Yes, imagine
that. These warm-ups.
Well, the warm-ups are to keep the muscles of the embouchure loose, as they can be, and yet still primed and ready to go to hold the shape of what the aperture does. We first of all have to take a breath, of course. Any instrumentalist would take a breath. But after we take the breath, our lips come together in such a way to form the embouchure, which is simply a French word that describes how the lips come together. And for those of you who don't know what an embouchure would be, I would invite you to imagine the very thin white seed from a pink watermelon, and then hold that between your lips. Just imagine doing that now. And now what you do is you take a breath in, and you attempt to blow that seed away, but keep your lips open at the same time, and you get what we call the buzz.
Wow, and without a seed, too.
Yeah, without a seed. But that has to show you that, it does demonstrate that the lips are open even though they're very close together. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any range.
We're going to hear what happens when we have chromaticism and valves on the trumpet when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is John Ailey. We're talking about his instrument, the trumpet. 1796, if I remember the date right, and 1804, biggest dates in the history of the trumpet, close together. What's going on?
Well, those are the two representative concertos from the classical period that trumpet players have to play. The 1796 date connotes the Haydn trumpet concerto, and the 1804, of course, is the Hummel trumpet concerto. And you have to imagine that trumpet players have been looking for the ability to play chromatically for, let's say, a better part of a century, and wishing to join the other chromatic instruments that are playing so beautifully. And a man by the name of Anton Weidinger decides to put keys on what looks like a modern-day bugle. There are five of them, and all of a sudden, this instrument can play chromatically. Now, this is an exciting time. Weidinger is living in Vienna. He goes to Haydn. He gets a concerto out of Haydn. He goes to Hummel. He gets a concerto out of Hummel. The intriguing part of having a chromatic trumpet and living in Vienna at this time, what other composers did he request a piece from? And we don't know that. We don't have any information on that, and that's so sad.
Yes, could have been some good stuff there.
I'm sure that there was. I am just sure that there was, but we'll never know. The Haydn was written in E-flat major, and the Hummel was written in E major 8 years later. And the overriding reason for the half-step ascent for the Hummel is that the instrument was better. The instrument was shorter by a half step, so the opening for the keys could be smaller. So the instrument was much more tight, if you will, and so had a lot better acoustical possibilities and success.
And Haydn is just really taking that ball and running with it. It's almost like an advertisement, isn't it, what Haydn does in his concerto? This is what the trumpet can do. Watch.
Well, at the very beginning, he writes notes that the Baroque trumpet could not play. He writes towards the end of the first theme of the exposition. He writes this chromatic scale where a really, really fine Baroque trumpet player could do. It wouldn't sound the same, but they could do that. But really wasn't possible. And he turns around and gives the trumpet player, after playing da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-dee, and then gives a Baroque trumpet lick that we've been playing for a century, da-da-da-da-da, on the low register.
you can remember.
And before we listen to the Haydn Concerto for trumpet, anything else that we should be paying attention to before we hear it?
Well, it's a very, very different sound than what you would be hearing from a modern E-flat trumpet performance today. It's much softer. Yeah, it has much more depth of sound. It's not anywhere near as brilliant.
Interesting that you chose a slow movement for that rather than one that just really, really rips through all the half steps, but it does give...
Well, there the half steps in there, the dee-da-da-dee, those...
Yeah, well, yes, the, for sure, right, yeah. Right. It does
the
make
Baroque trumpet would not have played before. Haydn is a genius.
And as we move out of the classical period into the Romantics, what did they do with the trumpet? How did the Romantic composers make use of it?
Interestingly enough, they don't do much anything with the trumpet early on. What's invented is the cornet. The valves that I mentioned earlier are applied to the cornet. And a really, really wonderful example of the use of the cornet in orchestration with two Baroque trumpets, if you will, natural trumpets, is the March to the Scaffold of Hector Berlioz. And it's interesting that Arban, who wrote the very great book that we use as a primer, you know, for our studying, was a cornet player for Berlioz so often. And, of course, Arban was the one that popularized the cornet in Europe to such a degree because he was traveling all over Europe with this new chromatic valved instrument. Well, Berlioz picked up on this. The number of makers who were making valved instruments at the time, most notably, were Sachs and Victor Machion, and they had some success, and they didn't have some success. But the trumpet really wasn't, well, it's hard to say. When did valves really go to the trumpet? This was more for what Mahler and Strauss used a little later. They had an E-flat trumpet that was, see, that would be a sixth lower than concert pitch, as well as the orchestral F trumpet, which was a fifth lower. And these instruments sound radically different than what modern instruments do today. But it was Berlioz who really got this valved instrument idea going in his orchestration.
And what's he accomplishing here in this March to the Scaffold from the Symphonie Fantastique? How does he use the trumpet?
Well, they play the main theme, and it's quite brilliant writing from the standpoint of volume as well as articulation.
It sounds like Berlioz.
Yeah, it sounds like Berlioz.
March to the Scaffold from the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz, heavy on all kinds of things. Did he add extra trumpets there, or is it kind of the standard number?
Well, the standard number for trumpets in an orchestra is three, but in this case it is two cornets and two trumpets.
What about a composer like Strauss? What use did Richard Strauss make of the trumpet?
Strauss, from my point of view, was a master orchestrator with the trumpet parts. Holy cow. He would use the trumpet to double winds, either from lower aspect or on top, sometimes doubling lower flute and so on. Fanfares, like we're about to hear with Ein Heldenleben, the battle scene. He used, in this particular piece, three B-flat trumpets, which would be longer than concert pitch by a step and is what we associate as the common instrument at this point in the trumpet's development. And then he used two E-flat trumpets that were a sixth below concert pitch. They're really long. And so they had a very, very, very wide tonal palette, you know, a lot of depth of the sound, not anywhere near the brilliance of the shorter instrument. You have to keep in mind that the shorter the trumpet is cut, the more bright it will sound. And he was very, very sensitive to that because these fanfares on the B-flat trumpets are really, really brilliant. And then a lot of the melodic stuff or the playing with the low brass is done with the E-flat trumpets, which have a wider sound and a lot more majesty perhaps to their sound as well.
From Ein Heldenleben. I'm tempted to say the swashbuckling Richard Strauss, because so often it has that effect. It's like the whole orchestra is Errol Flynn, you know, sliding down a rope to the deck of the ship or something.
And the trumpet's going awfully high in that.
Very, very high. Very, very, very full sound. Very, very present sound, yeah.
We're going to hear the sound of trumpets making jazz when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is John Ailey, professor of trumpet in the School of Music and also the principal trumpet player for the Madison Symphony Orchestra. We've been listening to pretty much all classical music, but the trumpet also has a part in jazz.
Oh, dear. All we have to do is go back to New Orleans at turn of the century and all this wonderful American music that was developing at that time. We could have an entire show on that. But to make a long story quite short, the influence on classical composers that came, say, from New Orleans or any other place where jazz was being played was really, really significant. And when Gershwin, who was one of my all-time favorite composers, had the opportunity to write An American in Paris, he wanted to have somewhat of this, what we could call jazz flavor, written into this particular piece to be reminiscent of what it was like to maybe hear a jazz set at home. So this American in Paris is a wonderful piece.
It'd be interesting to know sometime how many historic recordings were, let's say, interpreted for the sake of getting it all on one side or two sides of a 78. We like to think of, oh, yes, this was the conductor's artistic intuition at work, but maybe it was just the record producer.
We will never know.
Hey, you belong to the Wisconsin Brass Quintet, right?
Yes, right.
Tell us about what the quintet can do and what kind of music it plays.
Oh, well, I'll start with most recently. We're playing a concert on Sunday afternoon live from the Chazen. We're playing a brand new piece, 7 years old, which I guess still in music makes it brand new, by Juan Colomer, who is a Spanish composer who lives in Los Angeles and does a lot of film writing and so on. And it's really an exciting piece, one of the most difficult pieces I've ever encountered. And then we turn right around and we're doing an arrangement of a concerto grosso that Vivaldi wrote, for strings, of course, that Bach arranged for organ, and then David Baldwin, who is the trumpet professor at the University of Minnesota School of Music, arranged for brass quintet. And so we play music that spans about 400 years. And, well, in our group, John Stevens is a composer and Douglas Hill is a composer, And our trombonist, Mark Hetzler, who's been with us now for 3 years, is also a really, really wonderful arranger.
So your instrumentation in the quintet is?
Well, we have two trumpets, we have a horn, we have a trombone, we have a tuba. And the trumpet players will play flugelhorn, E-flat trumpet, cornet, piccolo trumpet. Trumpet players are the ones that, with the different lengths of instruments and so on, will change the color of the group. And so that's really, really enjoyable.
And some of the recordings that you've made of your own quintet?
Well, our first recording, which we'll hear a little bit of, is called Fabrics, and that has two of John Stevens' works on it, his first quintet from 1986 and second one from, I believe, 4 years later. And then a piece that we commissioned for our... We were founded in 1972, and this would have been our 15th anniversary. We commissioned Vern Reynolds to write another brass quintet, his second brass quintet. And that's really a hard piece, too. But what we'll be hearing is the Autumn movement from John Stevens' Seasons. And for me, this is probably, this is really the most beautiful brass writing I've ever encountered in the quintet. When we first read it, after we'd finished reading it, there was just this silence in the hall. I don't know how long, but it was long. It was noticeably long. And we were all the members were just kind of going, wow, that's really beautiful. And it is. And that was almost a line I could put in the sand that started all this musical expression that you hear from other quintet composers now, too. And I think John had such a huge influence on the writing, composing that other composers do for brass quintet.
Thank you.
That is really beautiful.
Thank you.
So mellow and, I don't know, very beautiful. Do you ever do something that's sort of more of a lighter note?
Well, years ago, and every once in a while when I'm out doing concerts out and about, I'll play the Virgin de la Macarena, and that's by a composer by the name of Koff, and then arranged by Koff. The composer is Monterrey, and of course the trumpet player that we'll hear is the very, very famous Mexican trumpet player Rafael Mendez. And Mendez came to this country in the early 1900s and made his claim to fame initially living in Detroit and playing in Detroit. Was playing at the Capitol Theater, and somebody was late, and his chair, unfortunately, was right near the entrance to the pit. And while he was playing, the late person bumped into him, and he cut his lip. Well, it did ultimately heal after being infected and this, that, and the other. It was a pretty awful injury, but he finally did end up getting better and then going out to L.A. to play in the radio and movie industry at that time.
Well, we'll go out with a visit to the Virgin of the Macarena. Well, you just don't hear it like that every day, do you? The trumpet. It's got a personality all its own.
Indeed it does.
And thanks for sharing some of the trumpet's personality with us. Our guest has been John Ailey. And you get to hear him also just about every week during University of the Air. He provides the trumpet part for our theme, and his wife, Anne, is the horn part of that duo. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.